I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Hackers have gotten very skilled at stealing trade secrets, financial information, and intellectual property. They can and do disrupt services and wreak havoc on the computer systems of corporations, universities, and governments. The cost to the U.S. economy is estimated to be about $140 billion a year. Fighting cybercrime isn't easy, since many of the hackers live in foreign countries, most notably China. That has complicated diplomacy. In fact, President Obama didn't raise the issue of cybercrime when he met in June with the new Chinese president. Well, joining us to talk about all of this is James Mulvenin, and he's Vice President Defense Group at the Center for Intelligence Research and Analysis and co-author of a book titled Chinese Industrial Espionage. And James Mulvenin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
No, nice to be with you, Marty.
I'm assuming this is a problem that is growing exponentially.
Well, it's certainly gotten a lot worse in the last 5 or 6 years, particularly Chinese hackers began attacking commercial companies, whereas previously they had been attacking, you know, more traditional targets like the U.S. government and U.S. military.
So focusing in on some of these Chinese hackers, who are they? What do we know about them?
Well, when we first started tracking these guys in the late 90s, it was a bunch of pimply-faced teenagers who were interested in just screwing around with things. But it has, over time, evolved into a much more professional, much more government-directed activity. And you have people literally operating there in uniform from 9 to 5 every day at their buildings. And we know this because the intrusion activity we see in the network really conforms not to a crazy round-the-clock hacker schedule, but really like a day job. And they come on at 9 a.m. Beijing time, and they leave work at 5 p.m. Beijing time.
And you're saying they're in uniform. These are government employees?
We know that the Chinese military in particular has a large number of these units called technical reconnaissance bureaus under their SIGINT service, which is very similar to NSA. And we also know that the Ministry of State Security, which is their external intelligence service, also maintains extensive hacking groups.
And do we know what they do with this information?
Well, that's a little bit less clear, but we know that, for instance, the government information that they're collecting on the U.S. government, on the U.S. military, and things like that would obviously go directly into their security apparatus. The commercial data, however, given the nature of the Chinese economy, given that China has many of these so-called national champion companies, state-owned enterprises, the surmise is that the commercial espionage data is handed to these companies to try and spur what the Chinese call indigenous innovation.
And what do they mean, indigenous innovation?
Well, about in the mid-2000s, we're all familiar with the incredible growth of the Chinese economy. I mean, it's in all the magazines and all the spectacular achievements. But in the mid-2000s, they realized that it's actually been a very shallow modernization. They import our components, they put them together, and they re-export them. There wasn't anything really deep about it. They weren't creating Chinese global brands. And so they said they needed to accelerate the transfer of technology from the Western companies that operate there and spur this innovation among Chinese companies rather than simply assembling our stuff.
And I'm assuming we're talking about pretty sophisticated hacking?
Well, it's interesting. The Chinese hackers traditionally have actually been very noisy. It's fairly easy to find them in our networks. I've often told people it's not that the Chinese are that good, it's that we're that screwed up. There are other groups like the Russians that are far more sophisticated. But I think as greater attention is paid to the Chinese, we really see them stepping up their game and starting to use much more sophisticated techniques.
And noisy the way maybe a burglar would be making noise if they're robbing your house?
It's the digital equivalent of the burglar sort of nonchalantly breaking the glass pane on the patio door. Not really concerned about how much noise they make. And just being very aggressive on a whole variety of fronts. And like I said, it has mainly to do with, you know, the problems that we have on the defensive side rather than any tremendous sophistication on their part.
Now, I read from CSIS that the cost of some of this cyber crime is something like $140 billion a year. Does that seem about right?
Well, I mean, Jim Lewis and his team at CSIS did a lot of very good work on that, but even he would be the first to admit that these are simply estimates. And the main counting problem that we have is that a lot of companies simply don't reveal that they've been hacked. And so, you know, it's a sort of, you know, without getting into a Rumsfeldian poetry reading, there's all kinds of known unknowns here that really make it difficult for us to count.
But is it the companies don't know or they don't want to say because they don't want to hurt their reputation, they don't want to hurt, you know, their stockholders, things like that?
A little column A, a little column B. I mean, the thing is that, you know, the trope in the computer security community is there's only two groups of companies, ones that they know that have been hacked and ones that haven't figured it out yet. And so some companies don't know. Some companies know but are covering it up because they don't want to have the loss in shareholder value. Some companies have come clean to the U.S. government, and some have paid the price for that. And so some of the legislation, for instance, that we're considering on Capitol Hill is designed to indemnify companies, to encourage them to come forward, reveal this data so that we can actually get a better sense of the scale of the problem.
But do you think it's possible to build the kind of security walls to keep the hackers out, or is it because the technology is constantly evolving, you just can't stay ahead of these hackers?
No, it's really the latter. And to be honest, the more sophisticated companies and people in the government have actually changed their mindset. They're no longer even focused on perimeter defense. It's not what firewall did you buy or what antivirus product you're running. People have come to terms with the fact that they have what is called advanced persistent threat in their networks. It's not going away. Mm-hmm. And we need to learn to live in an environment where we have compromised hardware and software inside our networks.
How do you do that?
Well, there's a variety of clever things you can do. I mean, first thing you do is you decide which of your data is the crown jewels. And the first thing you do is you don't connect that to the Internet. secondly, there's all kinds of sophisticated things that you can do that we do in our company networks where you can live inside encrypted virtual spaces inside your own compromised network. So you can continue to work even though you know that the enemy is surrounding you.
We can do that, but do we do that?
Oh, no, we don't, because it's expensive and because it's complicated. And most importantly, as you can imagine, it's inconvenient. And since the national motto is give me convenience or give me death, that's usually the primary impediment to effective computer security.
And you think that is our national motto now?
Unfortunately,
convenience trumps everything?
Convenience, mobility. For instance, we all know that mobile banking is not terribly secure. But if you're the only bank that doesn't offer an iPhone or Android app to do mobile banking, then people are going to go elsewhere because they love that convenience. So we know that we're doing something that's not relatively insecure, but we just love the convenience of it.
But can we assume that the U.S. is doing the same to Chinese and other countries trying to hack their computer systems?
Well, as General Hayden, the former director of NSA and CIA, has said, you know, we're the best in the world at this. So, of course, it's reasonable. But the one major difference, and this is absolutely critical, and, of course, the Chinese don't believe us when we tell them this, the United States is the only country in the world that does not conduct commercial espionage on behalf of its companies, both because it's banned by statute and also for some very practical reasons, we wouldn't know how to share the information.
Oh, that's interesting. But I mentioned this in my intro, that President Obama didn't raise this issue of cybercrime when he met with the new Chinese president. This was back in June. Do you think that was a mistake on the president's part?
Well, I think actually it was raised extensively, because cyber has now become a critical issue in the bilateral relationship, and perhaps the more important place to look is that a couple of weeks ago we had our strategic and economic dialogue with the Chinese, which is the very senior level dialogue, and it was held in Washington, and there was an entire day devoted to a cyber working group to talk about all the critical features of it, whether it involved in economics or trade or military relations or whatever. And so I think it really does have the attention of high-level officials in the Obama administration.
So we are talking about it, maybe just not in public.
Well, it's difficult to talk about in public, particularly in light of the recent unpleasantness, because the Chinese feel like they have a bit of the moral high ground on this issue right now after years of us criticizing them. We're trying to figure out sotto voce ways of raising our concerns about this issue without naturally playing into some of those discussions.
But do you think this is a kind of cold war that we're waging? Obviously, it's not the wars we have had with other countries overtly, but a more kind of covert cold war?
It is. It's very much a gray intelligence war. and has only recently become part of the public consciousness. And, you know, a lot of that was due to the fact that many years we had what was called an attribution problem. In other words, the nature of the Internet, the nature of the network meant that it was very difficult for us to say definitively that this was a Chinese hacker who did this, but it could have been a Romanian hacker spoofing off a Chinese server back into the U.S. Mm. The difference now is that we have much better attribution, and so the focus on the policy side has been, what do we do about it?
I'm looking at a piece in the L.A. Times dated July 25th, or just last week. Five Russians and a Ukrainian face federal criminal charges of hacking into computers of major payment processors, retailers, and financial institutions, stealing more than $160 million credit card numbers, causing hundreds of millions of dollars of losses. And we're talking about things like 7-Eleven, Wet Seal, JetBlue, and other, I guess, organizations or corporations.
Right. No, I mean, and this is a big problem, particularly in Eastern Europe and Russia, and Brazil are the sources of more organized cyber crime, where very sophisticated hackers are taking advantage of weaknesses in the network systems of banks and of credit cards and the way we do things. I mean, you have to remember, Marty, this entire thing we call cyberspace, this entire Internet that we've built this gigantic global economic edifice on top of, was never supposed to be, you know, the network was never designed for security. It was never designed for anybody to use it for malicious purposes, and we've been gluing security onto it ever since.
It was designed to be open and to share information, yes?
It was designed for scientists to talk to one another. And so some of the original designers will tell you to this day that they never thought there was a need for, you know, secure authentication and other things that would have given us greater security. And basically people say we need to re-architect the Internet, but frankly, it's like repairing an airplane at 30,000 feet. It's not easy.
You're saying it can't be done, or it's just it's going to require a different kind of thinking and perhaps different technology?
All of the above. And to be honest, one of my disappointments with the stimulus spending we did a number of years ago is that we were very focused on bridges, but we could have, in fact, re-architected some significant parts of the network such that they could have had greater security.
About 30 seconds before our break, can you give us one quick example?
Well, for instance, there's something called IPv6 where we could actually secure the way that people look for sites on the Internet and the way that the whole Internet map is developed. Right now that's unencrypted, and it'd be very easy for us to turn on the capability to encrypt it and get rid of all the spoofing.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We're talking about the problem of cybercrime, estimated to cost the U.S. economy as much as $140 billion a year, although because of a whole host of reasons, we probably don't really know exactly how much it is costing the U.S. economy. We are talking with James Mulvenin, Vice President for the Intelligence of the Defense Group. I hope I got that right. I can hardly read my own handwriting here. Co-author of a book called Chinese Industrial Espionage. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents Michael Feinstein and Tony Award winners Christine Ebersole and Betty Buckley in an evening of Broadway and the American Songbook's greatest hits, Friday, August 2nd. A night with the ambassador of the American Songbook and two Broadway legends that the whole family can enjoy. Tickets for Michael Feinstein and Friends, Friday, August 2nd, and all Mann concerts are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are proud of our international sophistication.
I love British accents.
Here we go.
No, really, I was in England one time for a couple of days, and they kept them up the entire time I was there.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the quiz that's funny in any language. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
Camden, New Jersey, a test city for the Affordable Care Act. Why? Well, there's this.
I could stick someone in a limo, drive them around the city, hire a personal doctor, bring their pills to them every day for less than what we're spending right now on hospitalization.
I'm Kai Rizdal, a new series, Healthcare in One City, over 1 year, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
tonight at 6:30 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with James Mulvenin, a vice president of the Defense Group at the Center for Intelligence Research and Analysis, wrote a book with several other authors earlier this year called Chinese Industrial Espionage. We're talking about the costs and possible cures for cyber crimes and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. James, I'm thinking also about universities, and universities in many ways are much about sharing information. At least that has been their original intent when it has come to the use of the internet. And I wonder just how vulnerable colleges and universities now are.
Well, you're right. By definition, the way that they've set up their networks to create an open, collaborative environment makes them highly vulnerable to this type of activity. And there was a recent article in the New York Times describing some of the very serious computer intrusion problems that some of our more technical universities have had. Because you can imagine, in some of those labs, very sophisticated work is being done, exactly the kind of technology that the Chinese and others would like to use to jumpstart their own technological innovation.
So what, I mean, I realize we're talking about governments and companies and also universities. Do you think this is a fixable problem, or it's just going to need constant sort of reform and reinvention as we go along?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. It's basically an ongoing problem that will have lots of twists and turns. The government would like to do more to collaborate with companies and universities in terms of sharing the kind of threat information they have, which is a real advantage that the government has. But in exchange, the government would like more collaboration in terms of people providing them with data, even minimized to, you know, get rid of, you know, U.S. person identities and things like that, so that the government can really understand what the attack surface, as they call it, looks like. In other words, what is going on and who is being attacked and what is being taken. And that conversation between those two back and forth is not really doing very well right now.
It seems like we should hire a bunch of hackers, right?
Well, you know, they do say the best defense is a good offense. In fact, one of the real dilemmas that people on Capitol Hill and in the Justice Department are wrestling with right now is companies' frustration at being attacked, looking to the government for help, feeling like they're not getting what they need, and then there's a new group of companies that have stood up and said, oh, we'll take care of it for you. We'll go out and hack, and we'll go get your data, and we'll bring it back, and we'll hurt the people who hurt you. That's technically illegal right now under the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but the Justice Department and Congress really need to more carefully define where the boundary line is.
I mean, the idea of getting some kind of revenge on hacking, or just using the skills of hackers?
Using the skills of hackers, you know, for instance, running deception operations inside your own network, luring in attackers, having them steal things that are wrong, tagging your data so that when they do steal it, the data goes to China or Russia and then waits a certain period of time and then comes online and says, here I am, here I am, so that you can go get it. All kinds of ideas like that are being considered.
Let me see what looks like Tina from Ambler has to say. And Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Your guest mentioned that the IPv6 could be turned on now and that it could be done easily. I just, in like 25 words or less, I understand it's very vague, but who would turn it on? Is it the end user? Is it ISP providers? Is it web designers? He said it could be done now and it could be done easily, and I was just curious of how that can be done over the entire internet.
And James, if you can describe what IPv6 is.
Well, the current version of the internet is IP version 4. And IP version 6 is what we call the next generation internet. And the reason we had to do that is we're running out of IP addresses. So it's a completely new way of mapping and addressing the entire internet. The reason why I say we can turn it on now is because every computer that you have, every server at the ISP level, all of them are currently IPv6 compatible. My MacBook Air is, your Dell PC is, and it's been that way for a number of years. The dilemma is that the backbone providers, the people who actually run the pipes on the internet, have not been incentivized to turn on that capability and to use it, and instead have continued to use the, you know, a kludge of the previous system, because, you know, because it's expensive and they'd have to make some transitions. But all of the equipment in the network right now could do it.
Tina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Mark from Exton has to say. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I wanted to ask about bank security, because I've been reading in newspapers that a lot of banks have been hacked and money has been taken, and that businesses, if their bank accounts are hacked, the bank's not even liable for that loss, because most people think the FDIC insures them against bank failure, only insures them against bank failure. So how do you protect yourself and your business bank account?
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we're going to be talking about passwords in just a couple of minutes and get into some of the nitty-gritty of some of the protection you're talking about. But, James, what do you say in response?
Well, I mean, the FDIC and the $100,000 limit does, in fact, cover any of your losses, particularly if it's because of the bank's fault. And, in fact, what we see is the banks writing off those losses and taking them on their balance sheet if, in fact, it's because someone got into their computer networks. Mm-hmm. Your first clue, usually, though, when there's been a problem, is that you will get a new debit card or credit card from the bank asking you to activate it. And chances are the reason they're doing that is because they're asking you to cut up your previous card because that information has been compromised. And so for a lot of consumers, that's really the first clue that they get from their bank. And I think there needs to be more transparency from the banks about what has happened and why.
Like telling you it's been hacked before they send you a new card?
Right. But, I mean, the banks are really bending over backwards to excuse the charges and things like that, particularly if it's a situation in which you were not responsible for the fact that there was a loss.
So why aren't banks and companies and financial institutions, why aren't they taking this more seriously?
Well, they are, and they're spending a lot of money on it. I mean, it really fundamentally has to do with the fact that the advantage goes to the attacker. I mean, as a hacker, I would only need to find one way to get in, and as a defender, you have to find every way to stop me. And there's so many vulnerable parts of the infrastructure. I mean, the way, for instance, that financial transfers are done between banks, all of those areas could be points of vulnerability. And so, you know, I would say the financial industry, ironically, probably does the best job of protecting their data because they have the most to lose. But even in their case, they still incur significant losses.
But is it time to revisit some of the treaties that we have signed and passed in the past to include some of these cyber crimes?
Well, I mean, what we're trying to do, you know, there is a move afoot to get better global internet governance, because right now internet governance is kind of a come as you are party. And there are lots of proposals underway that would say, okay, this network is now simply too important to be left to be a self-organizing system. We need to have governance. We need to have rules. We need to have, you know, more uniform technology. And you can imagine the fight that's causing on the one hand between the governments who want to see that, and on the other hand, the privacy and non-governmental organizations that fear the internet being taken over.
But it does seem like an instance of technology just outstripping the laws or just, you know, very much ahead of the laws.
No, and this is the fundamental dilemma with the internet. Not only was it never architected to be secure, but the pace of technology change, as you mentioned earlier, is vastly outpacing the ability of the Congress or the executive branch or any other actor to keep up with it. The minute they, you know, it takes them 18 months to solve a problem, and by then we're already on the next generation of problem.
Well, James Mulvenin, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, Marty, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Vice President, Defense Group at the Center for Intelligence Research and Analysis, co-author of a book titled Chinese Industrial Espionage. So how many passwords do you have? Do you remember them all? Are they secure? We're going to be talking about some of the do's and don'ts of setting up and securing passwords. And joining us is Dan Gooden. He's IT security editor of Ars Technica, and he's been attending Password Con, that's a conference on the next generation of password security at Las Vegas this week. And Dan Gooden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And are you in Las Vegas?
I am indeed.
And how's the conference going?
Well, the conference has been fascinating. It wrapped up yesterday. We had 2 days of some of the greatest minds, you know, luminaries in password security that, you know, shared a number of new insights that, you know, kind of bring home the fact that, you know, passwords really are a challenge technology that is kind of showing its age. And yet even as passwords are weak, there really isn't anything here in 2013 that is prepared to replace the password. So as flawed as they are, unfortunately, they're going to be with us for the indefinite future.
And have you been watching hackers hack passwords?
Well, you know, I mean, it's really fascinating to watch some of these folks at work. You know, they can take a bunch of, you know, what are known as cryptographic hashes. These are the cryptographic representations that are used to obscure passwords, and they can begin cracking them and deriving the you know, plain text or, you know, human readable passwords from those, really in just a matter of seconds. So
really?
Yes, I have indeed.
And is it possible that, I mean, you're talking about in seconds they can figure out, they can crack a password?
They can. I mean, they're using computers to do this. Right. They typically have graphics cards. These are the same types of cards that lots of people use to accelerate the graphics in their online games or their videos. And it just so happens that these things are very, very good at cracking certain types of passwords. So the typical scenario is that a website has suffered a security breach. The password database that contains these cryptographic hashes that I referred to a minute ago have been extracted, and now the race is on for the hackers to crack those hashes and recover the corresponding human-readable password from these before the website can send out notices to its users to change their passwords.
Well, let me ask you some practical questions to actually open up the lines as well. I'm sure listeners will want to talk to you. We are talking about cracking passwords and what can be done to make passwords more secure. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Dan, what are the common, I guess, mistakes that people make when they create their passwords?
Well, the most common mistake is picking, you know, any one of, you know, literally tens of thousands of really easy, super common passwords. Password is a good example a common password. Password 123 is another example. 123456 or 123456 7. Those are all examples of extremely common passwords. They're so common that they are at the very beginning of the list when a hacker is trying to crack a password. Probably the other most common mistake that people make when they're using or choosing passwords is that they use the same password across every account that they care about. So that might be their LinkedIn account, their Gmail account, their Facebook account. And the problem with this is that if LinkedIn has a database breach and all of their passwords are stolen by hackers, if I can then crack the password for you, and you use that password on Gmail,
sure.
Now I can compromise not only your LinkedIn account, but your Gmail account. And if you use that on six other accounts, I can compromise all of those accounts. So I've now basically gotten wholesale access to all of your digital domains. And the problem frequently, you know, the problem with using the same password everywhere is that you're really completely exposed, whereas you can contain the damage if you have multiple passwords that are significantly different for each account that you care about.
Well, and here's my problem. I'm sure it's a problem for a lot of other people. I can't remember my passwords. And where do you store your passwords that they don't get cracked or hacked?
Well, there are pieces of software that you can install on your Windows or Mac machine or on your Android or iPhone smartphones that are called password managers. And they're really phenomenally helpful programs to have. In a sense, they allow you to remember only one master password that ideally is going to be very, very strong. It'll be 16 or 17 characters, which may be a drag, but the nice thing about it is that that's the only password that you'll actually have to commit to memory. You type that 16 or 17 character password into your password manager, and then the other 40, 60, whatever, however many passwords that you have for each individual account are stored there. So that's really the best thing that somebody can do to remember and store really long passwords is to not try to remember them. Remember one of them, use it, and you know, if that frees you up to then start using a separate password for each account you care about that's long and complex, then that's a good thing and will help you be more secure.
But do you suggest people change their passwords on a regular basis?
You know, there's some debate about that. I think the more important thing is to change your password when you think that the old one might have been compromised. Now, I'm in Las Vegas right now, and I'm attending several different conferences that are known to be attended by hackers. And I'm connecting sometimes to networks that I don't have a high degree of confidence in. So the first thing I'm going to do when I get home and I'm on a network that I care about is I'm going to go and change all of the passwords that I've used while I'm at this conference.
Wow.
So, you know, some people say change your password every month, every 3 months, every 6 months. There's some debate about that. I think that the more important thing to do is if you have used your password on a sketchy network, even if you think that it's secure, it might be just out of an abundance of caution, it might be a good idea to change the password in those cases.
And I've been on some of those networks, and they do tell you that they are secure. I mean, is the idea to trust but verify?
Well, I think maybe you're talking about the website that's telling you that they're secure.
Yes.
I'm talking about a Wi-Fi network that
is
at a Starbucks or something like that.
Right.
And what people should remember is that, you know, the Starbucks Wi-Fi network is just works by public airways that anyone can monitor. And so they can monitor the radio signal that travels from your smartphone to the Wi-Fi access point. And if you're not using some sort of encrypted channel to send that password, somebody can just pluck that password right out of the air, the same way that people can listen to this radio signal that is carrying my voice right now. So that's the thing that you should never trust. There are some encryption technologies. A lot of times, you know, people are probably familiar with seeing an HTTPS at the beginning of their web address, and that is an indication that that is connected. So if you're typing a password into a page that has HTTPS in front of the address, then there is a high degree of you know, likelihood that that password will be encrypted. But, you know, things go wrong sometimes. So that's kind of what I'm talking about when you're using a network that you don't trust enter something as sensitive as your password.
Well, Dan, we have to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We're talking about protecting our passwords. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Please Touch Museum at Memorial Hall in Fairmount Park, the Children's Museum of Philadelphia, supports WHYY. Please Touch Museum offers two floors of interactive exhibit space, daily theater shows, musical programming, and a historic carousel. Families may enjoy the museum's long-standing mission of learning through play. Please Touch Museum is conveniently located off I-76 and features on-site parking. PleaseTouchMuseum.org or 215-581-3181. On the next Fresh Air, some easy recipes for preserving summer fruits and vegetables from Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen. They've contributed to a new do-it-yourself cookbook. They'll also answer some cooking questions from the Fresh Air staff. Join us for the next Fresh Air. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Is someone who prepares a lethal injection for a death row inmate the same as an executioner?
Where are the ingredients coming from? Who is compounding the drug?
Georgia law is protecting pharmacists being challenged, and an execution is delayed while the whole question of secrecy is examined. A capital case next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. How many passwords do you have? Do you remember them all? We're talking about how to create stronger passwords. No pet names, please. And we'll be talking about what's coming up to replace the password. Talking with Dan Gooden, security editor at Ars Technica. In fact, he's in Las Vegas where there's a password security convention taking place. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, please do give us a call. Dan, is it true? Don't use cat names and dog names. I mean, you know, we know our animals' names, but does a hacker know their names?
Hackers who regularly crack passwords have word lists that in some cases are billions of words long.
Wow.
And you know what this means is that they have cracked so many passwords over the years, and they've exchanged lists with other people who have cracked passwords, so many passwords over the years, that they've literally come up with billions of words long. They can use super fast computers, you know, computers that, as I mentioned earlier, typically have you know, one or more graphics cards that are used, you know, more often in game, to accelerate graphics in games, and they can just cycle through billions of guesses per second. So what this means is that almost any pet name in the world, almost any name, of a person, first and last, will be in there. Cars will be in there. Rock bands will be in there. You imagine anything that's in the dictionary, any brand name, you know, anything, almost any word that a human being would recognize is going to be in one of these word lists. So pet names are a definite no-no, unless your pet name happens to be, you know, a randomly produced unpronounceable word of some sort, you know, that contains ideally, you know, special characters and upper and lower case letters
right.
and numbers.
But so,
you know?
Right, exactly. But that's that. What you're telling us is use, I guess, a nonsense word, throw in some capital letters, lowercase letters, some numbers, some other material, so to speak.
Yes, ideally, you know, the ideal password is going to be a minimum of 9 characters long. It's going to be randomly generated. That is, I'm not going to generate it because remember, I now have the benefit of a password manager that's going to store this, so I don't have to remember it. And on top of that, I can instruct my password manager to generate a randomly produced password that has, you know, a set minimum, you know, 9 characters, say, that is going to, you know, contain both upper and lowercase letters, numbers, and special characters, you know, like an exclamation point or a greater than sign or a less than sign or something like that. And I'm going to say, okay, generate this thing. It's going to spit it out. It's not going to look, it's not going to be anything that I can pronounce. It's not going to be anything that looks like a letter. That looks like a word.
Sure.
It's just going to be a random sequence of letters. And then that is going to be my password for the time being for Twitter or Facebook or whatever it happens to be. And I don't have to remember it. That's the most ideal way that a person can come up with a password that is going to be the hardest for the types of people at the conference I've been attending to crack.
Well, let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about passwords and how to protect them and what the hackers know that we might not know. And again, Dan Gooden, our guest, security editor of Ars Technica. And that phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. We have Matthew from Langhorne joining us on Radio Times. Matthew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty and Dan. Great to talk to you.
Thanks.
Dan, big fan. I've been reading Ars Technica for over a decade. I love the site.
That's great.
What I wanted to suggest was a method I came up with myself some time back, It's actually based on an old game show. It's where I got the idea. It was on MTV called Smush. And what they would have the contestants do is the answers to the questions that were posed, they would actually have to overlap the words. So the ending of one answer was the beginning of the next. And you would have to come up with this whole chain of words combined and say them all out at once. So, for example, the first answer would be Grant, and then the second answer would be antithesis. So the ending of Grant, A-N-T,
right,
matched the beginning of antithesis. The only thing when you're coming up with this is that you want to make sure that the two words actually don't stand on their own. You know, there is Grant and thesis.
Sure.
You know, so it, in this case, it doesn't because of the I, but, you know, that's an example of something that I do. And I usually try to come up with at least three words that I can use back-to-back. And those usually are not likely to be in those hash tables that Dan is talking about.
Well, Matthew, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dan, does that make sense?
That does make sense, and you know, without actually seeing some specific passwords that would be produced by this, I can't give it, you know, a full endorsement. But it sounds like a reasonable way to go. The reason that I am a little bit cautious is that in general, the same things that make a password memorable to you and me are the same things that make them crackable to crackers. Mm-hmm. So the more memorable the technique is, the more vulnerable it is to cracking. And we've seen this, you know, over and over again. Something seems like a good idea at first, and it works for a while. But, you know, I mean, there was a time when people said, well, okay, I know that I shouldn't use Aerosmith as a password because, you know, Aerosmith is all over the place, but I'm going to be clever and I'm going to replace the A with an at sign and the E's with the number 3. And because nobody will crack that. Well, you know, people today still do this. They put they'll use password and they'll replace the A with an at sign and the O with the number 0. It makes no sense to do this. That, you know, password that's rewritten like that is every bit as vulnerable as password as it appears in a dictionary. So the only thing that gives me a little bit pause about what Matthew is suggesting is that it is a pattern. And if enough people repeat it, the crackers will figure this out and they will figure out a way to circumvent that technique or attack it.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Let's see what Grady from Westchester has to say. Grady, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Dan. I have kind of a silly question. This password discussion is almost akin to looking for the perpetual motion machine, and there probably isn't a real answer. But I just have a really stupid question. Suppose I used the cube root of the 4-digit year of my birth. That number is replicable, but it's easy for me to remember, and it can be very long.
So the cube root of his birth. What do you think about that, Dan Gooden?
Well, I'm highly opposed to any password that contains only digits. And the reason is that digits can are susceptible, even large digits, you know, even digits that are 10 you know, digits long. You know, a password that's 10 digits long is highly susceptible to a technique known as brute force attack. This is, I'm just going to start with 0, I'm going to go to 00, and I'm going to end with 999999, you know, 10 digits out. And there is a key space that in hacker speak they call it a key space. What it really means is just the number of possible combinations. When you're talking about numbers, there are only 10 of them,
right.
And so you can measure the key space by, you know, of a 10 digit password by taking 10 to the 10. A 9 digit password would have 10 to the 9. A 9 digit password would have 10 to the 9 combinations. That's a very, very small number of combinations. And so one of the first things that a cracker will do when he's trying to attack one of these tables will just brute force, you know, 10 or so digits out. So I would strongly recommend people not use solely digits in their passwords ever.
Grady, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dan, let me ask you about security questions that we get asked. You know, what was the name of your best friend growing up? What's your mother's maiden name? Things like that. Are they helpful? Do they provide security?
Well, they are helpful to both the person trying to remember the password and
right.
to the hacker who's trying to breach your account. So, a few years ago that when, you know, Sarah Palin was running for vice president on the GOP ticket, she had her Yahoo Mail account hacked. And the, you know, college student who hacked it was able to do so simply by answering security questions, and the answers were available online.
Oh.
They were things like, where did you meet your spouse? And what, where did you graduate from high school? And, you know, things like that. So I don't trust security questions at all. I tend to treat my security question as a second password. So I will tell my password manager to generate a long password, 15 characters long, and that is the name of my dog for the purposes of my security question.
Let me see what Paul from Paoli has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, Paul.
Oh, hi, sorry.
No problem.
I heard the discussion about the password manager, and I understand how that can help with websites. My question is around the smartphones with things, for example, like an Apple iTunes account, where if you're downloading or looking to purchase an application, you end up having to input a password. If you have that long, random-generated password that no human remembers, how does that password manager help you with that, or doesn't it?
Mm. Dan?
Well, there are password managers that will run on your Android or iOS smartphone. So in those cases, for instance, one right off the top of my head is 1Password, and that runs on pretty much every operating system that's available. So, you know, we're talking about Windows, Mac OS 10. We're talking about Linux. We're talking about Android. iPhones. Pretty much everything that's available. So there are, in fact, password managers that will run on your smartphone, and they can be we all know what a pain it is to type a long password into onto a tiny keyboard of your smartphone anyway. So a password manager can really help you in those cases too.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm wondering, Dan, even just looking ahead, and I was reading about how instead of using actual words in the future, it might be, our retina or our voice or our heart. and this is how we, in a sense, sign on instead of using a password. Is that in the distant future, near future? What do you think?
Well, what you're talking about is known as biometrics, and it's just using something that only I have, a fingerprint, an iris scan, some other physical attribute that belongs only to me, to prove that I am who I say I am. And it's already being used in many cases, but these are by no means perfect, and they're subject to many of the same inconveniences that people find with passwords. For instance, my fingerprint is very easy to extract. If you give me a glass of water and I drink it and then I hand you back the glass, there's a high degree of probability that you can extract my fingerprint off of that glass. Now, does that mean that you can now log into me? Kind of the same thing with iris scans. There have been reports, the BBC reported a few years ago that somebody had his finger chopped off by somebody who wanted to get at an account that his fingerprint was used to access. I don't know if the BBC was correct in that. I haven't been able to verify that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was true, and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of these types of things in the future if fingerprints become as commonly used to access sensitive accounts as passwords are now.
Let me see what Harry from Lansdale has to say. Harry, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about not just the encryption of passwords, but just the encryption of data. I know that in sensitive areas of the world, we sometimes use like IPIGs or Internet Proxy Gateways. When you're at the Starbucks and you put in your password and you're on the HTTPS site, that doesn't mean your traffic is protected, right? I mean, so your traffic, whatever port it's going over, can be monitored, too. What do you recommend for that?
Harry, thanks for the call. Dan, can you answer that?
Yeah, well, in theory, if the website that you're visiting has HTTPS in the address, then the traffic that it's carrying is going to be encrypted. And it's generally strong encryption that is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to break. Now, the problem is that occasionally only some of that traffic is encrypted, and that may be what the caller is mentioning. But in theory, if the main payload of that page is encrypted using, you know, HTTPS, then it is encrypted, and it's not going to be viewable by the person that happens to be sitting next to you at the Starbucks that's sniffing the traffic traveling between, you know, the data stream traveling between your computer and the Wi-Fi access point.
Harry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sam, we have to say goodbye to you, but what's on tap for you today at the convention in Las Vegas?
Well, today is day two of the Black Hat Conference, so I now am changing tracks, going from PasswordsCon to Black Hat.
Oh, really?
And we have a number of very, you know, cutting edge attacks on things like web encryption. The last caller mentioned HTTPS. There is a new attack that is able to extract email addresses, social security numbers, other sensitive secrets that are contained even when they're protected by this HTTPS web encryption.
Wow. Well, it's been a great pleasure, Dan Gooden. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's security editor of Ars Technica. We appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. Check us out at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our intern today, Jessica Crocker, Bob Alls, our engineer, and Radio Times produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.